This episode, I'm joined by Lou Marcos, who is a professor in English at Houston Baptist University. He is the author of multiple works on Christianity, the work of C.S. Lewis, the work of J.R.R. Tolkien, and more. And in this episode, we discuss his latest book, From Plato to Christ, How Platonic Thought Shaped the Christian Faith, alongside discussions on belief in relation to the postmodern world, Gnosticism, C.S. Lewis, Dante, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Hermetics, gain access to some exclusive content, and keep the podcast running, then please find links in the description below. And if you would like to become part of the community, please also find links in the description below. Enjoy. So, Lou Marcos, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast. We are going to be discussing your book, From Plato to Christ, How Platonic Thought Shaped the Christian Faith, which was published by IVP Academic in this year, 2021. And this is a book, as you'd imagine, basically about how Platonic thought shaped the Christian faith. And as I was saying to you just before we got going, for anyone who wants an introduction to Platonism and Plato's work in, let me think, is it the Plato section is sort of about 100 pages. If you want a hard and fast introduction to Plato, which is extremely erudite, this is the book to go to, because it's an incredible introduction to Plato on its own, let alone what it's doing after that with Christianity. But before we get going with the book, Lou, just tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is you do, and how this book came about, because you said you're working on it for quite some time.
Good. Well, my name is Lou Marcos. I'm a professor of English and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University in Houston, Texas, where I've taught for 30 years. So the years have gone by quickly. And the things that I tend to write and teach about are anything with ancient Greece and Rome. So, of course, I love Plato. I love the epics, particularly. All I love the history. So I teach all those things. Also, I'm a C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien scholar. So I'm always writing and teaching about them, apologetics. And my actual specialty, James, is the British Romantic and Victorian poetry. So I've been out to what is it called? The Lake District and things like that, and spoken in Oxford and stuff. So I'm definitely an Anglophile. American literature, it's okay, but British literature is where it's at. And so Wordsworth, Coleridge, Byron, Shelley, Keats, Tennyson, and I've written on them as well. So I love the great books, let's put it that way, and the great ideas. And there is no greater figure than Plato. And many people know infamously that Plato kicked the poets out of his perfect republic, and we might talk about that. But the fact of the matter is that Plato is in some ways the greatest poet there ever was. He's writing in prose, of course, but his imagination is just tremendous. And in that 100 pages that I talked, that you talked about in the opening section, I talk a lot about Plato, but I devote two full chapters to Plato's myths, because he's got his philosophical arguments, what we call the Socratic dialogue. He works out the definitions. He does it in a very accessible and powerful way. And then when you think he's going to end, he just lets loose his imagination and creates these myths or allegories. It's basically the same word. And in those myths, he incarnates these truths. And about 12 years ago, I published a book also with InterVarsity called From Achilles to Christ, Why Christians Should Read the Pagan Classics. And I covered Homer, Virgil, Dante, and the Greek tragedies. And I mentioned then that I should probably mention Plato too, but he deserves his own book. And it took a decade or so, but I finally got around to writing the Plato book, because I think he may be the most important proto-Christian, a pagan writer whom I believe God used, the God of the Bible, Yahweh, used to prepare the Greco-Roman world for the fuller revelation of Christ. And so my passion is Plato, but my greater passion is what's often called today bringing Athens and Jerusalem together, showing the connection between our Greco-Roman and our Judeo-Christian heritage. And, you know, what is Europe and America but a product of that serendipitous crisscrossing of those two streams? And Plato is one of the most important figures in preparing for what Augustine eventually did and brought the streams together.
Okay. You mentioned Plato as a proto-Christian. Is there any other key figures that you would definitely underline as proto-Christians?
Well, I mean, in terms of philosophy, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, and Cicero are absolutely essential. But when we talk about literature, we've got Homer and we've got Virgil. We've got the great Greek tragedians, Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, even Ovid, with all of his crazy mythological stories, there are great truths in there that in many ways are preparing, I think, the world for the coming of Christ. And as you probably know, James, anybody that wants to bring the two together, our most important passage in the Bible is Acts chapter 17, when Paul goes to the Areopagus, Mars Hill. He goes to Athens and he looks around and he sees there are idols everywhere. And at first it sort of hurts his heart. And then he sees there's an idol that says to an unknown God. And then he said, well, may I speak to you? So he goes up to the Areopagus, and it used to be a governing body. But by this point, it was a bunch of Stoics and Epicureans getting together to discuss the issues of the day and decide whether we'll allow these new ideas into our city or cancel them, right? And so he addressed them. And it's the famous speech where he says, men of Athens, I see in all ways that you are a very, very religious people. I even see that you have a tomb to an unknown God. And then he says the sentence, I believe, the entire Greco-Roman world was waiting to hear. He says, now, therefore, what you have worshipped in ignorance, I will proclaim to you as known. And he goes on to say that the God, you know, who created the world does not dwell in temples built by human hands, but out of one man, he created every race of men. He set their times and places, but that they might reach after him and grope after him, though he is not far from any of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. As your own poets, pagan poets have said, we are his offspring. Now, one pagan poet named Epimenides said, in him we live and move and have our being. Another poet named Aratus said, we are his offspring. And in both cases, the he is Zeus. But Paul sees that behind that pagan statement is a sort of pagan prophecy of the greater truth that is to be revealed. And Plato, we could talk about this, are full of these almost intimations of the greater truths that are to come, right? And, you know, a lot of people debate about this, James. When you read Plato or Aristotle, but especially Plato, a lot of times he says God, and a lot of translators put a capital G. Is that right or wrong? I would say ultimately it's right. He does not know Yahweh. I don't think he's getting a vision. He did not read the Pentateuch or anything like that. But what he is realizing, as Socrates was starting to realize, and it's carried on Aristotle, is, you know, if there's a God, he can't be like the gods of Greek mythology. Can't be like the gods of Homer that are sleeping around here. There's got to be a God who is the standard of ethics and morality. It must be a higher God. And in the Timaeus, Plato comes very close to a creator God that's outside of time and space. Only place in the ancient world where you get anything close to that. And it's like he's groping towards the truth. And I think it's okay to use that because he's understanding that if there's a God, he must be holy. And that's why the thing that bothers people the most about Plato is when he talks about kicking the poets out and more than that, of censorship. Oh, we can't get the young people reading Homer. Okay, let's understand what he's saying. This is not like a modern person censoring the Iliad and the Odyssey. This is like not allowing your kids to read satanic books. I mean, because if a young person reads Homer without any understanding and sees God's acting like this, he's going to think, oh my gosh, this is how moral and ethical people act. So it's what it's like is in the book of Acts. Guess what? There's a place where they burn books, right? But why do they burn books? They're not burning the Greek tragedians. They're literally burning books of spells that have curses and things. So they're like, we're not doing that anymore, right? This is not, I won't read Harry Potter. This is, I will not do a seance and play with a Ouija board, which I would never do. I've been a Christian for a long time. Mm-hmm. I read all the pagan stuff, but I would never mess with the Ouija board because you're opening yourself up foolishly to things that you shouldn't be opening yourself up to. So let me let you jump in there. It's a big introduction.
No, you definitely shouldn't. What do you mind if I ask, what are you of a strict denomination or?
Well, I've got a sort of interesting testimony because my name, Marcos, that K tells you it's Greek. All four of my grandparents were born in Greece. And so I did grow up in the Greek Orthodox Church and came to know Christ. But during my college years, I actually was a member of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. I got involved in Bible studies. And slowly, this is back in the 1980s, God slowly moved me into the evangelical world. And I was saying, do you go to London or do you avoid it?
What, London, just generally the city? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I avoid it. I haven't been in years.
You avoid it. Okay. But have you ever gone to All Souls Langham Place? That was the great church where John Stott was the preacher, and then the preacher emeritus. Well, back in 1985 was when I got to go and spend a whole semester in London, and God was already moving me towards the evangelical world. I even had a believer's baptism just the year before, and I was struggling with all these things and trying to decide whether, and it was actually going to All Souls Church and meeting the people there. It would be too long of a story, but God used it to move me in there. But it's great to be a Lewis scholar because I get to speak for every denomination because everybody likes Lewis, and my heart is mere Christianity. So I'm learning from all, you know, I haven't lost my Orthodox side. And in fact, I don't know if you're seeing this in England, but a lot of my most Christian students now are doing the opposite of what we did in the 80s. In the 80s, the ones that were Bible-believing, Christ-centered, born again, they were all leaving the Orthodox, Catholic, High Anglican and becoming, evangelical Baptist. Now I'm seeing a sort of reverse. I'm seeing a lot of my most serious Christian students becoming Catholic or Orthodox or High Anglican, Anglo-Catholic, as you say, we say High Anglican. And I think it's because they're hungry for liturgy. I think we've gone maybe too much into the Jesus is my buddy and get rid of all the iconography and stuff like that. So it's an interesting movement, but hey, God's using it, and it's allowed me to sort of minister to all different denominations because I've got a little bit of experience in all these different places. And again, Lewis is the perfect person to speak to all believers and to focus on what we share rather than the little things we disagree on.
Well, we can get to that idea of why people are moving towards, Orthodox Catholicism, etc. I think probably in relation to the postmodern world, right? But we'll get to that question because I need to ask you the hermetics question. You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Oh, I will tell you right now. Can you imagine a little dinner party with Plato, Dante, and C.S. Lewis? Those are my buddies, okay? And there's a direct line from Plato to Dante to C.S. Lewis, with C.S. Lewis being influenced by both of them. And to just let them talk about what it means to seek after the good, the true, and the beautiful. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Because all of them are, in a sense, philosophers, but they've taken philosophy and incarnated and made it come alive in the myths, in the Divine Comedy, in Lewis's fiction. I'm teaching a class in the Chronicles of Narnia right now. And Michael Ward is a good friend of mine, and he teaches at Houston Baptist University as well, mostly online, but he comes every 2 weeks. And to get that bigger picture that we've lost and we've sort of let go to the wayside. So, yeah, that would be a great conversation.
One thing that would interest me with that, I mean, you have the Lewis vision of hell in The Great Divorce, of this, this bus ride of Napoleon being thousands and thousands of miles out, right? The divorce, the alienation, pure alienation. You have
my favorite Lewis book, by the way. Great Divorce.
Mine too. Yeah. You have Dante's vision of hell with the ice and the huge, fat, cumbersome Satan. What would, if they were to go onto that tangent, what do you think Plato would add to that? What would be, did wow. he well, some sort of vision
I mean,
of that?
Plato would understand that ultimately the journey that Dante's going on from Inferno to Purgatory to Paradiso is coming out of the cave. Right, it's not that hell's not real. Hell is real, okay. But all of them would understand this. They would use different language, but all Plato, Dante, C.S. Lewis, they would all understand that. Okay, it's not that our world is an illusion, and Plato didn't really believe that either. He didn't really believe it was completely an illusion. He knew it was real, okay. But compared to the thundering reality of heaven, to the triune God, to the forms, the world of being, as Plato calls it, it is like living in the shadowland. They all saw that. And hell what did Augustine teach you? We can throw him in there too. Sin, evil, is not a positive thing. Sin is a privation. Sin is a lack. It is a perversion or corruption of that which is good. And so we need to move beyond that. What's the trouble with the people in hell? The trouble with the people in hell is that there's almost nothing left to them. They've become their sin. And a lot of people are like, why is Dante so mean to the sinners? Doesn't Jesus teach us to love the sinner but hate the sin? Well, he does. But the problem is that in a very real sense, there is no sinner. The sinner has become his sin. He's lost his humanity and shriveled up into nothing, where the movement towards the truth, the good and the beautiful, is a movement into greater and greater reality, a movement into greater and greater light, right? To the sun, the good, which is the form of the forms. Plato didn't know that the good was personal. He didn't know it was a personal triune God. But he knew that the greatest thing was the beatific or blessed vision, in which we move out of the darkness into the light and contemplate that absolute truth and goodness. And, you know, I pray that somehow Plato made his way there or something and now knows what Augustine found out, that the forms exist, but they're in the mind of God. And the triune God is the ultimate form that we are journeying towards.
And that truth, as Lewis makes clear in The Great Divorce, is overwhelming for those that, you know, don't really want to, aren't ready for it, right? When they step onto the grass, it's like, is it like razor blades?
Yes, that's right.
Too much.
They're so shriveled up that he calls the damned souls, he calls them the shades. There's almost nothing to them. They're like a greasy stain on a window. You can look at it or you can look right through it. They're so insubstantial. Yeah, they can't even bend the grass. In a very funny bit of irony, Lewis is one of the ghosts at this point, and he's so nothing that he walks on the water. Not because he's Jesus, but he walks because he can't even sink into the water because they have no substance. Whereas the saints are the real people. And I think we need Plato again, evangelicals, to remind us of the thundering reality of heaven. Have you ever been able to get N.T. Wright on your program?
No.
It would be great because N.T. Wright has helped. And as I understand it, things are even worse in England than they are in America. And what I mean by that is, how many Christians do you know think that when we die, we become angels, right? Completely unbiblical, completely unchristian, unfortunately popularized by my favorite movie, It's a Wonderful Life, we need N.T. Wright. In our country, we have a great guy called Randy Alra. Randy Alcorn wrote a book called Heaven. He's kind of doing it in America, but reminding us that our ultimate destiny is to be in resurrection bodies, living in a physical heaven, physical in a way we can't understand. Mm-hmm. The difference between the hard, dead seed that you plant and the acorn that comes out of it, actually the oak forest that comes out of the acorn. But again, Plato is somebody we need to remind us that, again, heaven is more real than the earth. God is more real, not less real. It's not like we're personal and God's impersonal. God is transpersonal. God is transcorporeal. He's more than. And even though, again, Plato still, you know, because he was a pagan, still kind of imagined a soul trapped in a body, he couldn't possibly understand incarnation. Still, if you really read him closely, he really segues with someone like C.S. Lewis and Dante in moving us towards greater reality.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that the search for this would begin for you, that you emphasize that Plato really is searching for capital T, big truths, right? And nowadays, and this is probably where we'll get onto the sort of contemporary, we'll probably discuss the contemporary default secular atheist variety of what's going around. Our understanding, even literally our understanding of things, is to fragment, is to isolate things into lower T truths of disciplines, which increasingly fragment and almost fractal out until you're eventually sort of just completely identified with something, some modicum husk of the academy, which you can't do anything with in terms of the grand vision. So would you say that that search for Plato, that important search for huge capital T truths, has been somewhat quashed by our current default mentality?
Oh, it has. You know, we go with Nietzsche rather than with Plato, right? Mm-hmm. We've lost those foundational truths. And another way to explain this is this radical move from ontology to epistemology. Ontology means the study of being, the thingness of things. So if you're an ontologist like Plato, you ask, what is the nature of God? What is the nature of man? What is the nature of reality? But now, of course, even Aristotle does epistemology, but it took over, right? And starting with Descartes and moving on, now we don't ask, what is the nature of God? It's, how do we know God? I mean, we don't even care whether he exists or not. All we're interested in is how our mind works and how we perceive the world. And, you know, Kant opened a Pandora's box. I still think there's a lot of great stuff in Kant, but he's opening up the Pandora's box until we can't even. It's weird because all the modern people are empiricists, right? If I can't see it, smell it, taste it, doesn't exist. But what is it? Everything is about how it's perceived in their mind. And so I think we've lost connection with reality. And part of reality is goodness and truth. And one of the reasons I love Plato and write about him and Lewis and all is goodness, truth, and beauty are a package deal, James. If you allow one of them to atrophy, they will all die. And a lot of, even when you find a good evangelical that says, I'm fighting for absolute truth and goodness, not fighting for absolute beauty. No, no, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. No, 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 don't be an elitist and all that sort of stuff. We need Plato to remind us what a good elitist is, right? And actually, oddly enough, Nietzsche is my favorite atheist because at least Nietzsche doesn't want to create a lowest common denominator world. He doesn't believe in truth anymore, but he at least wants beauty. He just doesn't understand that it doesn't work in his system if there is no absolutes. But at least he wanted to stop the kind of, you know, liberally theological Christianity that was dead. That's the God that he said is dead. I just wish he would have come back and seen a vision of what is truly true and beautifully beautiful or whatever. But we have lost connection with that. And we think it's somehow, I don't know, it's somehow bad to look for anything that's true, that we're somehow putting people down. And of course, when I say there is real goodness and truth and beauty, that doesn't mean I always know what it is. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're all searching and struggling for it, right? We can disagree, but the fact is that it exists and we're seeking it. Now, when I said, Kant opened up a Pandora's box. Again, I'm a romanticist. I love Wordsworth. I wrote my dissertation on the Prelude. I love Wordsworth. And he also opened up a Pandora's box to make everything about self-expression. But you know what? The reason he was turning to the countryside and to the beautiful Lake District and away from the city is because he was trying to find that which is eternal and permanent. And he thought maybe we would find permanence in the countryside more than in the city where everything's changing rapidly. He wasn't a cultural relativist, but unfortunately, he helped to move everything into what, what's that guy's name? The great Alistair McIntyre called emotivism and subjectivism. And, you know, everything is only the way we perceive it. That really wasn't. Wordsworth was just trying to find another way to access that which is eternally true and permanent. But as we move more and more into the modern and postmodern world, we lose. We actually lose faith in epistemology and we turn to linguistics. And now with deconstruction, we don't even have faith in language anymore. There's no access to anything that is fixed or true. There's no center. That's what Derrida would say. No center. Mm. No logos.
Well, one thing I'd say is, could we almost say that the postmodern world is a world which reveres the Pharisee, right? The Pharisee in terms of they absolutely abide by the truths they found, but they never allow good to come in, right? Good doesn't play a part.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So it's always an absolute abiding of, well, we just keep deconstructing, we keep finding the truth, but while you're doing that, you're avoiding all this goodness and beauty, which you're just bypassing and not actually constructing anything.
And it's not, and this is what happened with, you're familiar with what they call the philosopher's God. That's the God who seems to have nothing to do but exist. That's why you read Lewis. God doesn't just exist. God is real. God is reality. Okay. Oh my gosh. We could spend all day talking about the Episcopal ghost in The Great Divorce. You like that scene?
Mm-hmm.
That's unbelievable. Well, you know, I don't think we need to talk about fixed realities and stuff. Don't you even believe God? You know, well, you know, and we've just sort of wandered away, and we need a taste of reality. Mm-hmm. And it sounds strange to say that Christians may need to go back to play. Now, you know, okay, you'll remember this. It used to be that if you were a theological liberal and there was something in the Bible you didn't like and you wanted to do away with it, there was an easy way to do that. You say, well, that's St. Paul. Anything you don't like in the Gospels or the Bible, you blame on Paul. I only care about the words in red. Of course, people that say that forget about the fact that Paul always talks about grace and Jesus talks more about hell and devils than any figure in the Bible. But let's not. Okay, today I'm finding evangelicals, people that consider themselves to be small, low orthodox, they don't like Plato because anytime they see something they don't like hierarchy or essential differences between masculinity and femininity or any kind of thing like that, they blame it on Plato. It's become very fashionable to blame Plato. And I really think we need Plato to anchor us again. As odd as it sounds, we might need this old pagan to remind us again of what it really means to seek after goodness, truth, and beauty, and that there is such a thing as hierarchy. Okay? You know, I write about Lewis, I told you. So I get published in all different magazines. And it took me a while before I realized something, that whenever I was published in a, you know, Catholic, Orthodox, Anglican, you know, high, they always kept it as St. Paul or St. Augustine, because I'm, you know, I'm usually more traditional like that. But whenever it was evangelical or Calvinist or something, they would change it to Paul the Apostle or Augustine of Hippo, right? Mm-hmm. And now look, it is true that the Bible says we're all saints. Okay, yes, that is biblical. But the real reason why these Protestants don't like the word saint is they're like, oh, you think you're better than me, buddy? You think you're better than me? That's the real problem, okay? And look, it's very clear that there are people who are better than us in sports or music, mm-hmm. singing, or all these, you know, all these, but spirituality? Look, and first of all, Baptists, we actually have saints. We call them Wycliffe Bible translators. We still believe missionaries are saints. So, but what I'm getting at is, and you know, it's kind of funny because this is invading England now too. You would think this was only be an American being uncomfortable with any kind of difference or good kind of elitism or hierarchy, but England's going bad too. They no longer are really understanding that, yes, we need to grow spiritually. It's still salvation by grace, okay? But there's such a thing as sanctification and growing more and more into the image of Christ. And yeah, some people are closer to spiritual realities than others. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that it's a works religion. And again, I've seen it too often. It's like, let's blame that on Plato. We don't like that. Plato, we want to just, again, without realizing it, what is that new book? The Rise and Triumph of the Individual Self. Oh, you've probably seen it. What's his name? Carl Truman.
You getting that book
over there? Yeah. No. It's what's often called the autonomous individual. Okay. Where it's me and everything's cut off and I am the center of everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my emotions tell me what's right and wrong. And this is becoming a problem. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if we really read the Bible, we would understand it's false. But mm-hmm. it's weird that we may need to go back to an old pagan to help us to learn to read the Bible properly again, which I think is a wonderful irony.
Okay. I mean, there's a couple of things I wanted to maybe touch on before I jump forward some questions to tie in this idea of hierarchy, but a couple of things because you mentioned them. Firstly, do you think, you know, you mentioned Kant's, specifically the Critique of Pure Reason. I've spent a lot of time with this text as well. You mentioned it as a Pandora's box, and it is because it's been read in so many different ways. It's unfathomable. Right. But so many secondary commentaries that I read on Critique of Pure Reason were like, well, it's one of the things it's dealing with is with God. And I don't think so. I really don't think so. And do you think that Pandora's box wouldn't have been so chaotic if Kant had spent some time and said, let me actually, because I always thought with Critique of Pure Reason, Kant was like, oh man, I need to remember to put God into this. And it's like an afterthought.
Yeah. Remember, go back and read Locke and Hume. Of course, I'm an American. We love Locke. I'm a conservative. But, you know, I mean, he talks about God and then Hume. I don't know what to do with that guy. Hobbes. Forget about Hume. He's the worst of all. He is an atheist. but Hobbes might as well be. But he's always talking about God. But I don't know who exactly he's talking about or thinks he's talking about. It's very strange. I think we blame Descartes too much. I think we should be looking more at Hegel and Hobbes and Locke and of course Hume. Forget it. Hume is the new atheist of his day. He's just as much of a jerk. Well, the proper English word is ass, as Richard Dawkins. I mean, it's just unbelievable. All this writing on the problem of pain, and he thinks he solves it in one paragraph of his book, or he solves he disproves miracles in one page. It's like, come on, why do people take Hume seriously at all? It's unbelievable. You can go on for that forever. I've got another book called Atheism on Trial, where basically I argue that all the new atheists want us to believe that all of their atheism is built based on new research and science and history and psychology. They're just recycling the same old arguments that have been around forever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're arguments that were not only destroyed by the Christian writers, Plato and Aristotle and Cicero destroyed them, you know, 2,400 years ago. So, you know, there's nothing new under the sun.
That's what I love about new atheist writers. They go, well, if God's real, why is there pain? You think, what? We seriously think we've never tackled that question?
We've never tackled it.
In 2,000 years, no one's ever thought, you're the first guys to do it.
The greatest thing is, you know, the beginning of modern theodicy, if you want to call it that, all starts with Voltaire saying, there was an earthquake in Lisbon. Now I understand that there is no good God. Like, as if there was never a natural disaster before, never a plague and all of this sort of stuff. And these people are, it's the craziest thing. And they keep raising. And that's why if we don't read the church fathers, let's start with the church fathers, but let's go back also to Plato. All of this stuff has been dealt with. We wouldn't have been fooled by the Da Vinci Code and all of its recycled Gnosticism. If we just read, we wouldn't be fooled by Marcion if we read Tertullian 1,800 years ago almost now. It's like I said, the answers are there, but people seem to think, Nobody's ever thought this before. We've got a lot of celebrities in America now that the deconversion celebrity thing where they're like, oh my God, I just realized hell is a terrible thing. Right? I nobody's ever thought about this before. And I'm ready to break and run and go away. It's really it would be funny if it wasn't so damaging. Okay. Again, Plato grounds us. Again, if there's one thing I'm trying to say, he grounds us. He opens our eyes to greater reality. He gives us a desire to move beyond small t truth and move forward to capital T truth. Mm-hmm. And life is that journey. Pilgrim's Progress would be another example. Life is that journey that we're moving along towards the celestial city.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And another thing you brought in, and I mean, we can just keep this as maybe a digression, but I mean, I'll just ask you it outright because I don't think he is. Do you consider Nietzsche an atheist?
Well, it's kind of an interesting point. Okay. It is true that when Nietzsche says God is dead, what he really means is the God of liberal theology is dead. Mm. And he's right. And good riddance. Okay. The God of the philosophers. It's hard to say he's an atheist. I think he wants to believe, but to me, what Nietzsche is really attacking more than anything are the absolutes, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, what Nietzsche would say is what we call absolute truth is something that we made up and forgot we made it up. You know, truth in an ultra, I'm trying to remember the phrase he uses. But there's too much about Nietzsche. And again, mm-hmm. the reason I like Nietzsche is, and of course, if you read him carefully, he's certainly not anti-Semitic at all. He actually respects the Jews. And there is some truth to the idea that religion is a slave ethic. The true religion of Christ is not, but sometimes religion is a slave ethic. It's the weaker people holding the stronger people down. I mean, I think he's right in his critique of a sort of false bourgeois, whatever you want to call it, religion, but he doesn't seem to be able to break out. He wants this Ubermensch, this overman, to soar beyond this middle-class morality and seek after truth, but he doesn't seem willing to find that truth. Mm. And come on, what's the ultimate reason nobody wants to find that truth? Because nobody wants to be accountable to that truth once they find it. It kind of comes down, you know, some of the new atheists have admitted, oh, yeah, I didn't want God to be real because I wanted to sleep around when I was in college. I mean, some of them just actually admitted that finally. I didn't want any stay on my desires to do things. And so, you know, C.S. Lewis said, you know, Freud says that God is a wish fulfillment, but actually atheism is a wish fulfillment as well. Mm-hmm. We don't want God to be there. We don't want that divine busybody. And that's why it took Lewis such a long time to accept God. He wanted to be left alone. Mm. I don't want somebody snooping in on me.
But I mean,
he knows when you are sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows when you've been bad or good. So be good for goodness sake, as if God is some evil Santa Claus who is a voyeur and watching you so he can give you coal instead of presents, right? I think that's what they do in England. Yeah. Don't they say that?
Yeah. But I mean, that's the most nefarious thing about atheism is that it sells itself as a blank slate. So it's not, you know, they always say you're conditioning people with your religion, as if as if we didn't have religion that is a completely unconditioned, which is like, well, that's just complete nonsense, right?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, there is a lot of brainwashing going on in atheism. Mm-hmm. It's not the natural thing. It's just like you know any parent who's, I've got a son and a daughter, anybody have a son and a daughter, understand the essential differences between boys and girls. You see it immediately. We have to train that. We have to brainwash them into believe that it's just a gender category that a society has affected on you. Right? We have to make them believe something that is so counter to any kind of common sense or essential differences. And we don't like that. I don't know why we're yearning after this, you know, this egalitarian world that flattens everything out. Who wants that? Who wants that radical kind of world?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people do, though.
Yeah, well, apparently they do, but I mean, that's part of brainwashing, is they think they want it. But I mean, this is one of the huge disagreements. I, you know, just to stay on this for a little second, one of the huge disagreements. I, you know, occasionally I'll listen to people like Ricky Gervais just to see, like, oh, what's going on with these.
Oh, really? Right,
yeah. And he said, like, oh, if people weren't taught religion when they were younger and they were just left until they're 21 to do what they want, he said we'd see more atheists. And I thought, no, I completely disagree in the other way.
Yes.
I think if you were just allowed, I think you'd open up and you would say, no, there has to be something. You know, there's something out there.
First of all, little children do not start by asking epistemological questions. They ask the ontological questions. Why? Why are things like that? Children are natural, intelligent design theorists. they immediately see that something's been made for a purpose, and they want to know what that purpose is and why it's there and why the animals are like this. It's natural that they're like that, right? And we're sort of created that way. I remember reading somewhere that of the first 100 words that a child learns, about half of them are linked to animals. Isn't it interesting that Genesis tells us that God appointed Adam to name the animals? I think that's a really interesting thing. Of course, the epistemologists would say it's the opposite, right? That they invented that story for. But where's the chicken and egg thing? Okay, yeah. But I don't know. I mean, but some of them are even like a Ricky Gervais is suddenly realizing that, oh my God, this has gone too far. These crazy people don't actually believe in free speech. Even he's finally speaking up, and he'll get canceled eventually too. We are homo religiosus, religious man. We naturally seek after answers and strive after God, and we do things. And a lot of times we go astray, and it becomes idolatry and whatnot. But folks, okay, evolution is not just Darwin. Evolution is the way everything is taught today. So we are taught today that all of us, humanity, we began as these little animists running around. And then we slowly worked our way up to polytheism and pantheism and monotheism and then science, right? Well, first of all, the Bible says the opposite. We all began as monotheists and fell away. And when you really start looking at these things and studying the old fairy tales and we're natural, but we've fallen away into idolatry and then other things. And atheism is a kind of idolatry because you're idolizing yourself and your reason as if that itself were God. As if atheism were true, then you couldn't trust your senses and you couldn't trust your reason, because then reason is part of the natural world and reason is unable to step out of nature and study it. So if there was only nature, you know what C.S. Lewis said, naturalism is self-refuting, because all there is nature, then there's no part of us that can step out of nature and come up with isms like naturalism. So we're stuck in the box. They don't. And there's a lot of atheists that are finally admitting that, you know, I know that we're just, you know, whatever, we're just machines and everything is deterministic, but I couldn't raise my children if I believe that. I've got to believe that they are individuals with a soul and a conscience and will and choice and all those sorts of things. So I can't really live in accordance with my worldview. And yet I do it anyway. Very strange.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, jumping back to Plato, and we were mentioning hierarchy. We were talking about hierarchy, and when I was reading your text, you know, this Platonic ideal of the philosopher king, which probably many people are still after, in relation to hierarchy, this immediately made me think of Joseph de Maistre, right, the French reactionary Catholic, who said, "We need a Catholic sort of state. You have the king, right, who's in communication with God, and then that goes down through civilization. So every single member of the kingdom is quite literally" under the king, who's under God. So it's all right, funneled back to God. Is this what Plato had in mind, like in that version, when he was talking about philosopher king?
The best way to put this is everybody has this idea that the Republic is nonsense and philosopher kings are nonsense. Study history a little more carefully, and you will realize that throughout the Middle Ages, when it was truly Christendom, basically it was the Republic, because it was on the top were those who pray, and then those who fight, and then those who work, which is basically the way society works in the Republic. And, okay, look, yes, there was a Holy Roman Emperor and things like that. But the real center of society, the real leaders of society for a long time were the people who devoted their life to contemplation. In other words, the bishop, the priest, the local priest, the monks, the nuns. These are the people that people look to as the center of knowledge. And who did they go to? They didn't go to the experts like we go to today, right? The narrowly specialized experts. They went to the wisest people who spent their time in contemplation. And that's what the philosopher king is. Okay. The reason why we need a philosopher king is we need someone to rule justly. But the only way you can rule justly is if you have a very clear vision of what justice is with a capital J. And it is those people who spend their life meditating on the good, the true, the beautiful, the just. They're the ones that can see through the phony justice. They can rise above the shifting shadows to see things. And really, and even the older respect for professors, We used to respect professors, and a lot of Asian countries still respect teachers because these are people who devote their life to seeking after the eternal truths. Now, the professor becomes the rebel, the revolutionary, the person that is the cynic and skeptic that breaks everything down, right? That, in other words, no longer a philosopher king, but a group of sophists, right? That's what we become, the cynic and the skeptic. And there's nothing that's more destructive than education. I mean, again, we are raising people to think the more educated you become, the more cynical and skeptical you should become. And to me, skepticism and cynicism is the death of real education, because you cut yourself off from truth and now feel superior to everything else. There's not that. I mean, in Plato, remember, the philosopher who comes out of the cave and now knows the truth, he's supposed to go back into the cave and help those people. And of course, what will happen to them? They will kill him.
Yeah.
Right? Now,
so from the Christian perspective,
yeah.
What is that person representing who's come back to the cave? Are they proclaiming that Christ is king, Christ is real, and this is all real? So we don't literally kill them, but we kill them via saying, no, we still want to sleep around. We want to want to party hard.
And we also don't believe, okay, if we really believe this was true and we really believed it was God's standards and we really believe that God knows what is best for us, we would listen. I mean, okay, Plato figured this out. Okay, all right. Why is it better to be a just man than an unjust man? And he has got one of his pupils, Glaucon, wants to play devil's advocate and force Socrates, it's ultimately Plato, but Socrates, force Socrates to prove to you that it's better to be just than unjust. And the way he does it is by creating two hypothetical characters. There is the purely unjust man, but he is so pure in his unjustice that he's convinced everybody else that he's just and he has power and control and is the head of the world. Then there is the perfectly just man, whom everybody thinks is unjust. And what will they do to him? They will arrest him, they will beat him, and they will end up impaling him. In other words, putting him on a tree, okay, putting him on a piece of wood, right? And it's amazing because it reads like a pagan prophecy of Christ. What happens when the purely true and just man comes? We will declare him a criminal and beat him and put him on a cross. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, he was thinking about Socrates, certainly, who was put to death. So, hemlock is a much nicer way to die than crucifixion.
Okay. Yeah.
But anyway, okay, what's going on here? This understanding that if a purely just man ever showed up, we would turn against him. He seems to understand. Just in a nutshell, why is it better to be a just man? Because if you are an unjust man, you basically have a soul that is in a constant state of civil war, and you are going to be miserable inside. Mm-hmm. And guess what? We all follow something. All right. I am the perfect tyrant. So who do I follow? Do you follow the laws? No, I don't follow the laws because I'm above the laws. Do you follow the parliament? What do you want to say? No, I'm above that. Do you follow it? No. Well, what do you follow? Well, the only thing you can follow are your base desires and lusts. And when you follow your base desires and lusts, it always leads you towards a self-destructive lifestyle and disease and horror. And it's just...
At that point, you are sort of the material, biologically intuited man that atheists go on about, right? You've reduced reduced yourself to that evolutionary flesh, like vessel of flesh that's just going, I want to go over there and, you know, eat that and sleep with that person.
You're just animated. Animated meat, nothing more.
Which is the Platonic split, right? They would be on that that bottom level of Platonism, of the material level, and just abiding by those chemical urges, as opposed to allowing themselves to, say, communicate or that higher level. To communicate with them, the level of the divine to communicate with them. Would that be somewhat right there?
Yeah, no, it is. We go down and down and down, and we sort of lose ourselves. I remember the last page of Mere Christianity. How monotonously the same are all the tyrants. How wonderfully distinct are all the saints. Because they say, I don't want to be a Christian because I'm going to just lose my personality and everybody be the same. Well, there's nobody more different than St. Francis of Assisi and Thomas Aquinas. And there's nobody more different than the saints because they are becoming their true selves. Right? How many people do you know that they think that they live their life by to thine own self be true. And I think it's the greatest thing that Shakespeare ever said. Well, just read Hamlet. It's the old windbag Polonius that says that. And he contradicts himself right now. Not to thine own self be true. What I like to say is to thy true self be true. But we're not going to know our true self unless we know our creator and the purpose for which he created us. If we don't know that for which we are made, then we're not going to know ourselves. Mm-hmm. And here's the funny thing. Okay. You know, everybody may say they're a sort of existentialist, right? You know, the mantra for existentialism is existence precedes essence. Mm-hmm. We're just born as a radical blank slate and we make it up as we go along. Mm-hmm. That's what the atheist and the progressive will give lip service to. But you'll be hard pressed not to find a person that doesn't really believe, well, I have this purpose and I need to find my life discovering what that purpose is and living up to it. And of course, if you're an atheist and a radical existentialist, an atheist existentialist, then that's nonsense. You don't have any inborn essence. You're just and you have to make it up as you go along. And whatever you choose is the right choice because there is no measure against what is the right or wrong choice.
And I mean, it's the great irony of atheistic nihilism, which I point out time and time again, right?
Yeah.
Why is it that atheistic nihilism, the absolute meaninglessness of everything, nothing means anything, why is it that it always gravitates towards hedonism, right? Yeah. If everything's meaningless, sleeping around is just as meaningless as being a lifelong chastity. Yeah, exactly. But it never does, right? Yeah. It's always, I'm a nihilist, so I get to do all the fun stuff. Right. And I just find there's something really peculiar there. They'll go, well, okay, so I think there is this meaning. And, you know, drawing this back to the cave analogy, this idea of, you know, what in a Christian perspective, what are they bringing in? It's what C.S. Lewis makes clear in his books, which isn't really taught at all, I would say, now in schools with Christianity, which is why I fell away from it for a time, which is Christianity isn't just this nice guy who's saying, dudes, just like be cool with everyone. Yeah. It's a struggle. It's tough to be a Christian. And that's what people don't want to hear is like, especially in a postmodern world where everyone's your friend.
Yep.
We don't like people who go, no, there's rules. You need to follow these rules. What? I don't get to have fun all the time? So
they don't understand the rules are there to protect you.
Yeah.
You know, it's just crazy. You know, they made a movie called, did you ever see The Cider House Rules? It's an interesting movie that tries to be nihilistic, but the characters that break the rules end up destroying themselves anyway. So it doesn't – like I said, there's such an inconsistent, you know, thankfully, most people don't live in accordance with their worldview. That now the one quote brave person that actually has the courage of his convictions is that terrifying person named Peter Singer. You know who Peter Singer is? He's the one that says, you know, a full grown dog should have more rights than a newborn child.
Common, right? Like not common sense, like practical philosophy.
Yeah. Like a super pragmatism and a super behaviorism stuff. But, you know, hey, yeah, that's right. If there are no other rules, then just do that. I mean, like I said, it doesn't make any sense because if you have another way of getting there, and so if you're a pure Darwinian, then of course Hitler is doing the right thing. He's just pushing evolution along. He's just doing survival of the fittest. You can't be a complete moral relativist and say apartheid's bad.
No.
The only reason apartheid is bad is because only way you can say we have essential value and worth is if we were all made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
If we're just a product of survival of the fittest, then we don't have essential value and worth.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
Well, I mean, this is one of the problems. I don't want to I'm sure some moral relativists might come up with someone like Foucault might come up with some interesting arguments. But the problem is, you know, surely moral relativism, someone say, we need to do this, 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 and this, and I think this, this, and this, and this. And you can just say, I don't agree. And nothing matters. It's like, I don't agree. I'm not going to do it. Why? Because I just don't agree with it.
Well, you know the old joke. It says, everything is relative. And you ask them, do you mean that absolutely? You know, it's a little circular tautological box, you know, that you can cut it. Crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I mean, one thing I do want to touch on, because I always like sort of practical things. And one practical aspect about Christianity that's always really appealed to me is the embodiment practice, right? The emphasis on the body, the ascetic practices, even through to the modern day, you know, some of the traditions that still stand, fasting, etc. And this understanding that the body isn't just this Cartesian, like, Right. It's the flesh over there. Don't worry about it. I mean, Descartes, as you said, don't be too mean to him, but he did do a fair bit of damage.
No, he started the mind, but yeah.
But I mean, in Platonism, do we see a synonymous form of understanding that the body is still this important thing, which didn't carry through to the Neoplatonists? Because Plotinus is all about,
yes,
just get rid of that thing. I hate literally. I know, so I don't know what happened there.
That's it. Yeah, we're too tough on Plato. He doesn't really say that the body is all evil and bad. And, you know, I mean, yes, how could you understand incarnation? Okay, the two into one. We're fully physical and we're in flesh souls. He didn't understand that. But if you read the Timaeus, his view of the body is a little bit higher there. You know, in fact, the angels have a body that's better and it's more tied into their soul and whatnot. But yes, I mean, here's something. I think most Christians are going to understand that for a long time in the church, there was the problem of Arianism. Okay. And Arianism says Jesus was a man, but he wasn't God, right? That's the Arian heresy that's been around forever, right? He's just a good man, a rabbi, but he's not the son of God. But what a lot of people don't realize today is there was an equal and opposite heresy that was just as, not more so. And these were the Gnostics. And the Gnostics said, as strange as it sounds, they believed God, but he wasn't man. What they believed was that Jesus, there wasn't a full incarnation, but Jesus just wore the flesh like I'm wearing this shirt and I'll take it off tonight and throw it in the laundry, right? It has no incarnational link to me. It's just a covering, because the Gnostics believed that flesh and even matter was inherently evil. And therefore, you want to get rid of it. And you have to understand, if you believe the flesh is inherently evil, then the incarnation is impossible. Jesus could not have become a man, or it would have dirtied him, right? And in Islam, no, you can't. God can't have a body, right? Now, there's a real unfortunate thing. If I went back in time and talked to St. Paul, I would have probably said to him, can you come up with a better word than the flesh? Okay? Because when he says the flesh, he means the sinful nature. It's clear when you read it, right? Because if he meant our skin, then it would be impossible for God to take on flesh and not become dirty. Right? Mm-hmm. It's clear what he meant, but again, a lot of people, I think they hear the word flesh. That's for a while, the old NIV said sinful nature instead of flesh, but that wasn't the best solution. We just have to explain to people what he means by the flesh. And let me tell you something funny from G.K. Chesterton. He said, you know, these people that hate the church, particularly the Catholic Church, they say paradoxical things. They say, you know, the thing I hate about the church is they keep telling us the body is unclean and it's unhealthy and they make us all into anorexic. I hate that about the church. And the other thing I hate about the church is that they persecuted those nice Gnostics. You see the irony there? Okay. It's the Gnostics who said, also the Cathars. Everybody wants to bring back the Cathars. Oh, how mean we were. The Cathars were Gnostics too. They said that the flesh was evil. Okay. They were heretics. They weren't just nice people. Now, yeah, they probably did have some good ideas about dealing with institutional corruption. Okay. Yeah. They had some good ideas. Okay. But their theology was ultimately Gnostic. And they were the ones that said the flesh was bad. That's what leads to a bad kind of asceticism where you're beating the flesh and things like that. Only it's the Bible that says matter is good. Flesh is good, but it's fallen. Mm-hmm. And again, it sounds crazy, but Plato can actually remind us of this. That was the problem. Now, but of course, even Augustine learned something from Plato. From the Neoplatonists, he learned that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But only in the Bible did he read, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. He's one that had a journey, a spiritual journey that took him through Plato and beyond. But he never dismissed the good things he learned from Plato. Okay, yeah, now look, there's two things we're talking about here. One thing is the need to understand we're in flesh souls. The other thing, though, and this is kind of what I meant about Descartes. Descartes set us off on the wrong road, right? But Descartes is important because he reminded us that the origin has to be greater than what it gives place, that the cause has to be greater than the effect, right? He is the one who told us that his proof that there is such a thing as infinity is we have a natural understanding of infinity. Well, where do we get that from? Right? The difference between finity and infinity is not quantitative. It's qualitatively different, right? And remember, Locke came along and said, no, you're wrong. I just keep counting numbers and numbers and counting that, and then I come up with the idea of infinity. No, you're wrong about that law, okay? And that's what everybody says today, right? We invented these things, right? And so Descartes had enough of Plato in him to remind us that the greater things are greater than the lesser things, right? That, mm-hmm. that what's that phrase? Water does not rise above its source. The origin has to be greater. And so that's the one thing that we need to be reminded with in Descartes, that he would make arguments like that. But we've moved away. People don't want those arguments. Locke, Hume, all these different people have cut us off and said things that are really not true. That's why Lewis, all of his arguments are about things that need a supernatural source. Mm-hmm. We could not have evolved morality. We could not have evolved our desire for the supernatural, right? The fact that I'm hungry seems to prove I'm a creature made for eating. The fact that I get thirsty proves I'm a creature made for drinking, even though I'm a Southern Baptist. The fact that I desire something supernatural seems to prove that there's something supernatural that is the origin of that desire. Because if all there is nature, then where did that desire come from? How could nature breed in me a desire for something outside of nature if there's nothing outside of nature? So that's kind of what I mean when I'm trying to revive Descartes a little bit. He at least understood that essential aspect of philosophy that I think we've forgotten today, even Christians sometimes. Mm.
Do you feel, you know, in the relation to that idea of Lewis, that we need this higher thing to... for any of these smaller things to make sense, these smaller things, you know, of our practical daily life, do you feel that in the modern secular world, we've immanentized the divine, and actually a lot of people, especially in relation to mortality, and I know this is going to sound ridiculous to many listeners will know I believe this anyway, but I believe many people in the West genuinely believe they're immortal until they're not. Like, they absolutely deny anything. And then in that way, they've immanentized the divine. They've immanentized the divine as a way to,
you know what the fancy phrase is? Who is it that said that? We have immanentized the eschaton.
Eric Voegelin.
Yeah, it was Eric Voegelin. Yeah, cool guy. He was a Baylor, which is not too far from me. And the, we've taken basically what Carl Steele, Christianity. Christianity is an eschatological religion that's moving towards New Jerusalem. He just said, okay, that's going to happen, but it's going to happen on earth, and it's going to be driven by history. I love these people that talk about chance. Chance is nothing, right? History is nothing. Nature is nothing. It doesn't have any will, and yet they talk about nature as if it were a willing, conscious thing that moved things forward. I think you're right. We haven't accepted death. And you know what I tell my students a lot? I say, I think what we should do, and the same thing in England, have you ever been to a church in England where there's a cemetery either in front of the church or behind the church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you actually go to one like that?
I don't go to one with that. There might be a couple of graves there.
Okay. But I wish we went back to that, because think how different if every time we went to church, we walked through the cemetery and were reminded not only of our immortality, but reminded of the communion of the saints that we're part of. I think it would be healthier. They used to do that in America too, way back.
That's all right. One of the problems with that is, especially the churches near me, they get so full that all the gravestones are really, really old. So even that might not help, right? People think that used to happen to people, but not anymore. We don't. That doesn't happen anymore. We just get burnt up and ashes lobbed somewhere.
And I'm odd. I mean, I do not think cremation is a sin per se. But, we've kind of moved a little bit too quickly into cremation, right? I mean, the fathers would have been horrified, because the reason that they buried was because they had a high view of the body, right? Mm-hmm. That, at the final resurrection, our body will be resurrected. Right now, we don't want to get legalistic and die in fires, okay? I mean, we don't want to go too much, but I do think we need to find a sense of goodness and safety. I was very disturbed by Body Works, where they take these bodies sort of plastic. It appears in the Casino Royale in the background. Daniel Craig is running through an actual Body Works. I think he's Argentina or wherever, Brazil or wherever he is. It's like, again, I'm not saying this is an evil thing, but we need to remember again that the body's important. And okay, you need to understand. I've got a colleague named Nancy Pearson, probably heard of her, and she was talking about what's happening now with the abortion debate. Okay. Look, everybody knows now that the fetus, is really viable life very early on. I mean, mm-hmm. They know that it's there. But what they've done is they've got around it by what's called personhood theory. And they say, okay, the fetus is living life, but it's not a person, right? And we have started to disembody ourselves. This is what's happening with the whole transgender thing. My body is nothing. I am my soul or my personality, whatever. And my body's just, I can do whatever I want to. I can chop it up. I can do all of these sorts of things. And again, we've lost, literally, we've lost our mind. We have completely lost any understanding of ourselves as enfleshed and embodied beings. And this is why you can actually link the whole abortion debate with transgenderism, because both of it is coming out of an inability to understand what we are ontologically as human beings. We are enfleshed souls. I'm not half soul and half body. I'm fully spiritual and fully physical. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, I'm incarnational. Now, not like Jesus, who is fully divine and fully human, fully God and fully man, but we are incarnational. And we also lost an understanding what incarnational marriage is. The two into one flesh. We come together and we're one, but we're still two. A husband and wife are not a thing with two heads. Okay. We're one, we're two. And a lot of these mysteries, maybe we need to go back to Plato to help us understand mysteries as well.
I mean, that sort of, that bodyworks thing is basically the idealization of like the atheist mentality though, right? See, yeah. Look, we're just flesh and atoms and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But the idea of death does bring about one question I wanted to ask about Platonism, Christianity. In terms of the teleology, in abstract, are Plato and Christ sort of aiming at the same teleology? Or Platonism, Christianity, is in abstract the same journey happening? Or the same end goal inside?
I think it ultimately is, right? Because even though, again, the big debate about does Plato actually believe in reincarnation? He's getting that from Pythagoras. But it is weird that the only place where he actually has reincarnation is in the myths, which is interesting. It doesn't appear in the Socratic dialogues, always in the myths, so he's using it. But you know what? Even if he does believe in reincarnation, the point is the ultimate thing is the beatific vision. We are ultimately moving past our world of becoming into that. Like you said, the thing that he's missing is not an understanding that it is a personal God, that it's still fairly impersonal, but it's a movement towards the ideal. We're on that journey. That's where we began, that conversation of Plato and Dante and C.S. Lewis. What is the nature of that journey as we're moving? And a lot of it is also teleological, because what is our ultimate purpose? What is our ultimate end? Where will we find that fulfillment? And let me just show you how beautiful it is. Okay, you know, in the medieval cosmological model, all the spheres, the planets, were fixed in crystalline. We call them the crystalline spheres. And as they rotate and hum, they produce this celestial music we call the music of the spheres. Plato also talks about it in Book 10 of the Republic, The Myth of Earth. But we don't hear the music of the spheres because our ears are so dull. Right? Mm-hmm. But Pythagoras said, because he believed in reincarnation. That's why he was a vegetarian, because he believed we might even become animals. But if we keep coming back as we grow as philosophers, once our soul reaches such a perfect state that we can actually hear the music of the spheres, then we will just go up and join the universe. Now, of course, that's not compatible in a literal way with Christianity in any way, but the idea of that journey of conforming ourselves to the image of Christ, it still is a legitimate thing. It's a metaphor for what should be the ideal. And again, it's not works religion, okay? It's moving and fuller into the light. Look, let's say you and I got a letter in the mail and we both won a 1-week trip to Rome. This will be the first time we go to Rome, right? And during the next month, you, James, all you do is sit around and do nothing. You figure out what you're going to pack. But I go to the library and get find about Rome. And I study Rome and I study all the ruins and all the history. Now, we both won our trip to Rome by pure grace. But when we get to Rome, who is going to benefit more from it? I'm going to benefit more because I have gotten myself trained and ready to be in the presence of that city and to take in and absorb as much of it. This is kind of what's going on in Dante's Divine Comedy, this is writings. The closer I come, that's what it's all about, right? I don't know what this is. Let's say it's 18 ounces, right? Let's say I have another jar that's 32 ounces, right? Let's say I fill this one up with 18 ounces and I fill this one up with 32 ounces. Which one is more full? Well, guess what? They're equally full. But I want to be a fuller vessel to be able to absorb more of God's goodness and truth and beauty and light. And that's kind of what all these journeys are about. And what I think in our day and age, maybe that real desire to grow. I mean, there are a lot of people that do that, but it's all about internal growth and moving inward and all that sort of stuff. It's self-centered. It's not moving out of the self towards the creator. It's moving inward, or it's an extreme version of monasticism where you have so broken down the distinction between God and man, you've become what's called a monist. And you're almost not a Christian anymore, okay? Because God is still distinct from us. There is a thing called theosis in Orthodoxy, that God became like us so we can become like him. Our destiny is to become like God, the participant dance of the Trinity. But we're still ourselves, Mormonism. They think that literally God was once a human being who worked his way up and is now a God, and we can become a God as well. That's not what theosis is. But our final destiny is to participate in heaven is also incarnational. I'm not going to lose myself in the one soul or be raised up and actually be a God and have my own planet like in Mormonism, being one with God, but I'm still myself.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we've covered a lot of ground, so perhaps this is a good place to finish up. Considering
connection. You can edit this, right?
Yeah, I can edit it so it's a bit more fluid. But whereabouts can we find this book, Amazon and all good?
Okay, yeah. If you go to Amazon.com, just type in my name, Lewis Marcos with a K. And all my books, I've got 22 books up there. And I've got another book. And if you're interested in the Plato book, another new book I wrote is called The Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek and Roman Mythology Through Christian Eyes. And by the way, I just found out something exciting. You see, I'm a very dramatic person, but I was never asked to do an audiobook. And they hired me to do an audiobook of my book, The Myth Made Fact. And I get to be really dramatic and all that sort of stuff. And apparently that's now available on Audible, if you've got an Audible account. You can get it through there on Amazon. But that's the best way. Also, if you go to YouTube and type in my name, Lewis Marcos, you can find my YouTube channel. I've got a lot of speeches and stuff up there. Those are all free, of course. We need to get ourselves back and don't read about Plato. Read, get it, and then dive into Plato yourself. You'll find it so energetic. Aristotle is a little drier, but Plato is really exciting. It's the joy of philosophical discussion, figuring out what words mean and all of that sort of stuff. And it's just really great.
Mm-hmm. And you're soon to release a new book on C.S. Lewis, right?
Oh, yes. I've got a book. Okay. There's a series out there called Blank for Beginners, Shakespeare for Beginners, Plato for Beginners. And it's really neat. They contacted me and they do these books in a sort of like a graphic novel thing with lots and lots of illustrations, but it's not a comic book because I wrote about 45,000 words of text. So it's not just blue bubbles. It is text, but it's illustrated by this really awesome illustrator that opens it up. And it's called C.S. Lewis for Beginners. And it covers his life and all of his major works. And I'm working right now on J.R.R. Tolkien for Beginners. I think it will be out pretty soon. I don't know if it'll make December. That might be too soon, but certainly within the next 6 months, it should be out. C.S. Lewis for Beginners. And we have to get, and also people that like to listen, there's a group called The Teaching Company or The Great Courses. And about 20 years ago, I did something called The Life and Writings of C.S. Lewis with a 12 lecture series on that. The Teaching Company or The Great Courses. And that kind of got me started in all the publishing and things like that. Okay. Anyway, lots of fun stuff out there.
Okay. Would you like to come on again and talk about C.S. Lewis?
Yeah, well, definitely. Well, let's do it again. It's good stuff.
Okay. Lou Marcos, thanks very much.
Thanks.